It's amazing how much we've come to rely on websites, isn't it? For most of us, if we want to find out about a local business or group, it's my first stop. I bet it's your first stop, too, for information. Unfortunately, what we find and how current it is can vary quite a bit. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Paul Hedges has, for many years, been the Information Technology Director at Wisconsin Historical Society. He's now the Emerging Technologies Activist in the Society's Library and Archives Division. He works on digital and audiovisual collections and projects, and he also consults with small businesses and not-for-profits and churches to help them plan for and manage their websites. And, of course, he's very pleased to have to answer your questions as well. Certainly, we are pleased to have him here, too. Are you considering building a website for your business or your volunteer group? He has some great advice to share. Maybe you have a website, but having a hard time keeping it fresh and up to date. Or what's going on with your computer? What do you need? Are there some software issues or other kinds of issues? We can deal with all those at 1-800-642-1234. Could email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my website at the Larry my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And I said activist. I really should have said archivist.
Archivists can be activists, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, you're probably an activist in some ways.
In some ways, certainly.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And let's talk about these small businesses or these nonprofits, churches, and their websites. What are the compelling reasons to have one?
Well, I think we just have to think about what we're looking for. When you go out and look for a church to visit or a restaurant to go to, you want to be able to look online and be able to make your decision. It gets very practical. Where are they located? When are they open? For a restaurant, if they don't have a menu, it can be really tough to make a decision to actually get in your car and go to that place. So these small businesses really need to have some kind of website that helps make them visible in their community.
Yeah, and so we think about kind of specific things that should be included. I think you sort of gave an example there with the restaurants, but what kinds of things do we need to have in there?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think you come down to questions of really what your business is and who your visitors are, who your customer is what are they going to be looking for? If I'm a church, I'm going to be looking to know, when do you have worship services? Where are you located? What is your church denominational beliefs? Who is the staff? Those kinds of things. If you're a service business, what kind of service you provide? Are you available 24/7? You know, basically being able to answer the question that the customer is going to bring when they come to that website.
And I know that having experience, my wife is, as a matter of fact, works, volunteers her time as keeping a website for our church and school going. And I think she does a pretty good job, but who is responsible for the site? I think, especially when you're talking volunteer groups or churches, this is a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, upkeep of a website is really challenging for small businesses and nonprofits. Volunteers play a strong role in maintaining sites. I think there's always the challenge of building a website that meets your customers' needs, but at the same time is maintainable, is not too large. So what we usually find is, for example, there's a couple of small businesses in Madison who they have a volunteer who maintains the website for that small business. There's a lot of changeover. You could have a changeover every year. So you don't want to create a website that's so complex, so complicated that when you've got that new volunteer who shows up, that they cannot maintain it, they can't sustain it. The flip side of that is sometimes you'll get volunteers or people who will come in and want to embrace it and really make it their own and very special, and they may have these grand ideas to triple the amount of pages or add a bunch of new content. And that can be a real challenge. I think the institution, the business, needs to make some decisions about kind of holding that maybe in check, because when that volunteer leaves, the next person may look at that extra stuff and say, I can't do that.
Yeah, understood. So what are some good options for building a website that's easy to maintain?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think that there are plenty of online services today. You know, in the past, my first website was built way back in the dark ages in 1995 in internet years. And back then, you had to do everything manually. You had to have an editor on your computer, and you needed to write your page content. You had to know HTML and various other programming languages, and then upload that file to a web server and do all of that work. Today, there are many, many, many services out there that provide some form of online, what they call content management system.
Yep.
So you may be familiar with WordPress, or there's large content management systems like Drupal and Joomla. But then WordPress.com is a web-based service. And many, Squarespace, Wix, Wix.com, those are all services that allow you to open your web browser, log in, and create and maintain your website basically without any special software.
Yeah.
And today you can build pages using an editor that looks like Word. You don't need to know the special codes that are going on underneath. So those are all ways to make it fairly easy to get over that technical hurdle.
Yeah.
And I think that is the thing that tends to scare people is the technical elements of it. Once you've gotten over that, and once you've found a service, really it's the content that is the most important. And how are you going to write your pages? What's the most important pages to create on your site? What kind of images are you going to put on that page? Do they reflect what you're trying to say? And how you say it is really important as well.
And, you know, I think it's pretty quickly you can tell if a site is not well maintained. I think there are some really big cues and outdated events would be an example, I guess. What would be some, you know, you look at something and you say, well, that was 2 months ago. What is that doing up here?
Right. Yeah. So part of that is to think about pages on your website as what kinds of pages are able to stand alone for a long period of time.
Yeah.
You don't put dates in them. You might describe what your business goals are or your mission. Those can last a long time. But if you have something down at the bottom of the page that says last updated in 2012, people are going to look at that page and say, they haven't really been paying attention to this website. The other is, as you mentioned, is blog type posts where they may change over time, or if you have events that are on your site and you may not have had a recent event in 8 months, that can send a message to some people saying, well, this business or this organization is not very active. And that's usually not what you want to be able to say to your customers. One church I know has tended to struggle with that, in that they actually do have regular events. It's just that the site doesn't get updated. So it's not accurately also reflecting the reality of that organization.
Yeah, and I suppose most of those organizations or most of those churches would probably are pretty active and have a lot going on, but it's just like, who's the person who's going to be responsible to put that up and put it up and kind of in sometimes in an engaging way, you kind of hope.
Sure. And I think that again, most of these services now, WordPress.com and Wix, et cetera, Squarespace, they all come with really nicely designed templates. And while it can, for those who may be design oriented, there may be kind of a desire to tweak those. I usually suggest that they kind of stay away from that, because by customizing, they are going to have to customize it in the future as well. So, but those designs are beautiful, and pick the right design and stick with it and work within it, and keep it refreshed and put content in there that makes your customers happy. And
are there tricks like to keep, and Linda, hang on there. We're going to get to you in just a second. Are there some tricks to keep a website looking fresh without a lot of maintenance? I know there are some things my wife does. You know, she rotates my images, for example.
Sure. I think that certainly the home page is an important landing page. It's kind of the first thing people see. Committing some time to changing out the images on that home page, maybe once a month, maybe once a week, putting up, even if it's just short snippets of information that might be a little more time-sensitive or time-relevant, is very helpful. And then, of course, there's the connection between their website and their social media. Very often, people will use their social media, such as Facebook, as a more immediate connection with their customers. And their website can remain somewhat static as the informational site, when people want to dig deeper into that organization.
Are there some people, I know there are people out there, job seekers, who could create a website to highlight their skills and background, perhaps? Anything different that you might add in a situation like that for somebody who's got their own site and kind of...
So if I was today, if I was just starting out in a career, I think it can be very helpful, especially if it is a career that is in the arts or in the computer sciences, is really a website slash as a resume can be very helpful. I was looking at some. Squarespace, again, does some. I know that there's a variety of other quick services now where you can get a free one-page website. And it's really meant to be a way to present yourself in a single page or a single long scrolling page about what your skills are and present the kinds of information as well as images. You know, if you're a photographer, it's a great way to say, here's my work. If you're a graphic designer, here's my work. Those kinds of services can really help.
Would you say that images are important, even if images aren't part of what you're, you know, if you're a photographer, obviously you're going to have images up there, but what if you're a writer or something else that may not really require it in a way?
Yeah, you certainly need to have imagery on your site. People don't want to see essentially just all text. So you want to have some form of images on the site. I think the question is always what kind of image are you going to put there? You know, there's a lot of stock imagery that can be pulled out. One of the places I love to check is that Flickr, which is a photo website, has Creative Commons public domain imagery that can be used for free as long as you put a little blurb in at the bottom that says where you got it from. So those are opportunities to find images that you can put into your website that may somehow relate to what you're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it depends. Many people, if somebody has a website that's a blog and they're writing articles about their daily experiences, they want to find maybe images that help make, you know, add to that message in that blog. Whereas if I'm a tile cleaning service, I may want to have somebody take some pictures of my workers, you know, cleaning floors, that kind of thing, or even some stock photos of happy customers.
Yeah,
putting those into the site can really help.
Yeah, absolutely. Judith reminded me, Wikimedia is a common place for images as well.
Yes. Yeah, so definitely any site that clearly says that they are public domain or they can be used with proper citation is fair game, and definitely you should go there. You don't need to pay for a large stock photo or go to a paid-for service. You can usually find most anything.
Paul Hedges is our guest today, many years information technology director at Wisconsin Historical Society, now the emerging technologies archivist in the society's library, and archives division. He works on digital and audiovisual collections and projects and consults with small businesses, nonprofits, and churches to help them plan and manage their websites. Linda in Pewaukee has a question for you. We'll get to her in just a minute. But just to remind you, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking websites, computers, software today with Paul Hedges of the Wisconsin Historical Society. He is the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Library and Archives Division. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Linda in Pewaukee has been patiently waiting, so let's go to Linda. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I do some graphic design for a nonprofit. My background is in print design, but I have taken some introductory classes of web design and Dreamweaver at our local technical college, but I just never quite overcame that hurdle of actually developing a website and having it go live. I just somehow, I don't know, was intimidated by that. So now the nonprofit that I do print work for has asked me if I would be interested in getting into their website. I think they use WordPress, and I've told them that, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing what it involved, but I wasn't ready to jump in with both feet because I wasn't exactly sure, you know, how much work it would be and what my capabilities are in relation to what they need. So that was one question, how difficult might that be? And with my print background and my web classes, you know, might it be fairly easy to slip into? And then my other question was, my computer is from 2002, and it has Windows XP on it, and I'm kind of on that fence of, should I upgrade it? Should I get a new computer? And how will that affect what I may try and do, you know, with a website?
Yeah, those are great questions.
So the good news, I think, is that the nonprofit is already using WordPress. And let me describe WordPress a little bit. So WordPress, do you happen to know, are they using WordPress.com as a service, or do they have a hosting company that has WordPress installed on it?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Okay. I'm supposed to have a webinar with the person that's actually doing it now, and then I will hopefully learn, you know, some more details. But at this point, I do not know that.
Okay. So it only matters in that sometimes it matters just in how much control you can have over the design. But WordPress essentially is set up so that you would open your browser, you would go to a particular web page and log in, and then you would be able to manage the pages and the various posts through your web browser. So to answer your second question, there would be no impact with getting a new computer on how you would manage this website, because essentially you'll be still opening Firefox or Chrome or Internet Explorer and going to that WordPress website and logging into it and then managing it through the web browser. You would not be using Dreamweaver or any other tool on your computer to be able to do that. Definitely, it's probably is time to upgrade your computer. Windows XP Pro is not going to be supported after the middle of this year, and so Microsoft will not be providing any security updates. So your computer will be much more vulnerable to viruses, etc. if you wait. On your first question, with WordPress, what it does is it separates the design from the content. And what I mean by that is that WordPress uses a template or a theme approach where you can maintain your pages and your posts, and I can describe the difference between those in a second, but it separates that from the actual design. So, for example, you can create a bunch of pages and then you can scroll through and preview various themes that take those pages and just apply different themes to them. So you don't have to necessarily worry about getting that theme exactly right the first time.
Mm.
It's great. I'm actually working with somebody right now who they have 780 blog posts on their website, and they want to change their theme. We don't have to go into each of those 780 posts and update the look of those pages. We just change the theme once, and all of those pages get updated. So
handy.
It is very handy, and it certainly saves a lot of time. So the one thing, Linda, I think that when you go through your training, is it will really focus on how do you log into WordPress, how do you create a page, how do you edit a page, if there needs to be tweaks to the theme, you can do those types of things. Are you familiar with the concept of cascading style sheets or CSS?
Yes.
So it uses that heavily. So
what is that?
So wow, cascading style sheets is a standard that is applied now to most, I'd say, all modern websites. And what it is it's, think of it as a configuration file where all of your colors and the behavior mm-hmm. of how a particular section of your web page looks. You want something to be an image to be aligned to the left or to the right. That information is stored in this cascading style sheet document.
Okay.
So what's great about that, again, is if you change the cascading style sheet, it the entire website gets updated. So you don't have to go into 500 pages or 6,000 pages and do it manually, because the cascading style sheet has done it for you. So WordPress uses that. The other thing that's very helpful with WordPress and its themed approach or template approach is that everybody is moving to something called responsive design. And what responsive design is it affects, essentially, is allows us to use websites on mobile phones, iPads, various tablets or mobile devices. It will automatically modify your website so that it will function and appear nicely on those devices. And so by having something such as WordPress where you can get what's called a responsive design template, you can apply that to that website and just automatically your website will be able to be used on one of these mobile devices. So you don't have to go through and do significant work on the individual pages themselves. So any other questions on
that,
Linda?
Help?
Yes, thank you. That was helpful. I think, you know, that was something that I was kind of wondering about as to, am I actually, you know, designing pages in a design program, or am I just plugging in elements to the web program that they're already using? And it sounds like it would be more like plugging in text and graphic elements, correct?
That is correct. So on a particular page, if you're editing that page in WordPress, you'll have, it will look again just kind of like Word. Mm-hmm. You'll have a bar at the top of the page that has buttons for bold and italics and align left, align right. It'll have the ability to insert an image, and you can align that image left or right or center. And it will provide basically that all of those tools to create that individual page. How the page looks to the public will depend on the theme. So think of it as that page is kind of embedded in this broader theme.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll still have some control over certainly the elements of that individual page, the paragraphs, the images, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on how much the nonprofit would like you to modify the theme, you would be able to go into the theme settings and tweak the cascading style sheet or some of the other code in there if that's something that you and the nonprofit would like to get done.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Appreciate your call. Paul Hedges, our guest today. He is the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Library and Archives Division, talking with him today about your computer and all, really talking, we're starting here, talking about web designs, especially for nonprofits or small businesses or churches. Questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Got an email from Adrian in Milwaukee, who says, I'm a published author interested in moving into the Kindle arena. My concern about developing a website has to do with directing traffic to the site. Could you talk about how to directing traffic?
Yeah, it's interesting. So... Excuse me. So so directing traffic to a site is there are many, many different ways to do that. There's what is often referred to as search engine optimization, which is making sure that your web pages are written in a way so that they are easy to find in search engines. There are also some technical ways to improve upon that. But I also think that, again, social media, Facebook, Twitter, certainly Google Plus or any of Tumblr, all of those are ways to engage your customers on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And then those are opportunities to remind people or point people back to your website. It's kind of like thinking that, well, those are where the people are at.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to be where those people are hanging out, and then letting them like your page and then communicating with them on a regular basis and then saying, well, I have this new book. It's now available in Kindle format. And then pointing them to where they can buy it or that book page on your website. This also kind of brings up the search engine optimization stuff. Some of the most common things that people tend to make mistakes about, probably the most number one problem is when people use the word click here and make that a link. That is problematic because what happens with the way Google will rank your website for certain search terms is that essentially you're telling Google that the words click here are important words because those are the words that are in the link. So what's to improve your website, what you want to do is you want to make sure that your links are always the words that you want people to actually be searching for. So, for example, instead of something like my new Kindle book is available for sale to get it, click here, and click here is the words that's the link, you would have the Kindle version of my book or the Kindle version of whatever the book's title is, would actually be the link to it. And that way, the words Kindle and the book title are basically a higher elevated search term and become more relevant in searching. So
yeah, that's a very good tip.
It, very often you find this all over the place. The other is take pity on all of us who have our eyesight is getting a little and eye-hand coordination is getting a little worse, is that the words click here are very small to click on. You yeah. really want to make sure that there's a nice big thing for people to click on. So you don't have to keep them small.
We had a Facebook question from Aris. Our township is starting a website for our cemetery. Any suggestions besides minutes, POCs, and rules?
Wow.
So that's one you probably didn't anticipate.
Well, you know, coming from a historical agency, we certainly do hear a lot about cemeteries. I'm going to assume that this is about an active cemetery, that it is a cemetery that continues to have people laid to rest there. So as an organization, certainly minutes, POCs, and rules can be important. What I'd be curious about is, though, is for me, again, mm-hmm. personal, if I'm considering laying one of my family members to rest at that cemetery, I think you would want to be basically telling me what it's going to take to do that. Who do I contact, etc.
What does it look like?
What is right? Exactly. That you are actually open for business. That you have people there ready to help it during this difficult time to make decisions about laying your family member to rest. Those are kind of different. My sense, looking at it from minutes, POCs, and rules, is that it's more about kind of the city side of things, mm-hmm. not the business side of things. But the other side of that is, of course, I'm an avid genealogist, and so I'd be curious: do you provide lists of who are buried in that yeah. cemetery? That would be valuable information as well.
Could there be testimonials, or maybe?
Well, it's about the service.
Yeah.
Is if they are essentially that website is there to tell people about the service they provide to the public, they need to understand how do I make decisions about using them versus somebody else, and making sure that they can answer my questions before I call them.
Yeah.
As much as possible. So you have to be somewhat empathetic to your customer and understand what their needs are, what they're trying to answer.
I had a Facebook comment from Ben. Just a few more points to consider. He thought as it relates to websites, he says websites should be responsive to mobile devices. And you talked a little bit about many people browse the web on their smartphone or their tablet, and so you need to take that into account. And you talked a bit about how to set that up with WordPress or whatever. Don't make the mistake of viewing a website as a one-time event. It's an ongoing communication with your audience. Mm-hmm. I think you certainly are mm-hmm. in favor of that. And then just like a car, you're not only spending money on the care, but you should be sure to budget for maintenance. And...
and that is definitely true. I think that I hear over and over again is that a business or a nonprofit will put a committee together, and there'll be a huge effort to build the site, and then we'll have conversations about, well, once the site is launched, how are you going to maintain that site? It is just as important to continue to maintain that website, and that usually kind of surprises people, which is unfortunate. You really need to be prepared to commit over time to maintaining that website. Think of it, I think people sometimes tend to still think of websites as a one-off print publication, when really what it is it's an ongoing part of your business that is going to evolve, needs to be maintained, updated, modernized, and that takes resources.
Yeah, it definitely does. Paul emailed and said too many people, including those who sell their design and program services, focus on appearance and features, featureitis over clear, useful content that is kept current. And simpler can also be more secure, less things to break or go out of date and be vulnerable. And whatever platform you do end up on, don't let it go out of date when vulnerabilities emerge. And in that sense, it can be well worth your while to keep your public website separate from your other IS services, like your email account support and so forth. If your website is compromised, the rest of your data then would remain secure.
Yeah, and I am a big fan of simpler is better. Simple is always better to those who are certainly getting started is and especially I agree with Paul here that sometimes when you go to a service they may have grand ideas, they may want to suggest that you put video on your website or you put some form of interactive component on your website, and that that gets dated. It gets dated quickly. So I usually tell people, let's get started with the most important basic information you need first. Let's get that online, and then let's look at your traffic trends. Let's talk to your customers 6 months from now, and that experience you've learned from. Let's go through that and let's make some improvements. Again, kind of focusing on starting simple and then moving and iterating through a richer experience over time. That can be a struggle for people. Mm-hmm. I think, again, partly because of this idea that you're going to build it, and then you're going to walk away. And
that isn't going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
Or things aren't going to turn out well.
No. A little side story. I was working with a customer the other day that really loved this one theme where there was this really large image on the homepage. It was very large. And they were really interested in that because that image, it was the first thing people saw. And it was very graphically designed. It was beautiful. And then but it was an odd shape. It was very wide and very short. And I said, so you're going to need to find an image at least once a month to swap out, because this is basically a kind of a promotional image that they had wanted to change out. Do you think you'll be able to find an image that will work in this space over time? And 2 months later, they came back and said, wow, we finally get it now. We understand that by committing to this particular design, we have to find the right kind of images to work there, and that was a struggle for them.
Paul Hedges is our guest today as we talk with him about, well, we've been dealing mostly with websites and that sort of thing, but he can answer your computer. You may have a computer issue. You may have a software issue associated with your computer. What's going on with it? You need some advice about the care and updating of your computer. That's part of it, too. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Again, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Paul Hedges, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here as we talk computers, web design, and a whole lot more with our guest Paul Hedges, who is the emerging technologies archivist in the Wisconsin Historical Society's Library and Archives Division. And obviously, as you listen to him, he knows a whole lot about what's going on in the world of computers and web.
And I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You know, one of the issues that comes up is how many people are, you know, actually going in to my site? How often do they go and that? And there are ways, aren't there, Paul, that we can check that?
Yeah, there are a variety of ways. You know, if your certain services come with their own what's called analytics or, you know, web traffic analytics built in. But I think most people use Google Analytics, which is a service by Google. You know, that is a great service. I install it in every single website that I help with. And that those analytics or those reports can then be shared to anybody who has a Google login. And what that does is essentially provides information on how many visits that you had on your website, how many page views, where people are coming from, how long they spent on your website, how many pages on average they viewed when they went to your website. And those kinds, that kind of information can be very helpful. I think it can also be overwhelming. There's a lot of data there. And what I typically tell people is to define what is the goal that you want for your website. If your goal is to make sure that people see this particular page, then, and if that page is getting very low traffic, then you need to consider maybe reorganizing your site or thinking about ways to drive traffic to that. If your goal is to sell more widgets off of your website, you can track that with Google Analytics. And if 1 month it's not much and the next month it's high, you can look at that traffic and try to understand, you know, maybe what happened. Maybe maybe you did some marketing in a newspaper or on Facebook, etc. You can actually see what other websites they were at when they came to your website. So you can, for example, see how many people come from Facebook to your website on a monthly basis. So that kind of thing is really important to get set up. And again, it can be overwhelming. Google has a variety of Google University type videos that will help people understand Google Analytics. But it's a powerful, valuable, sometimes overwhelming, but a good tool to use.
Talked with an IT person who is does it on the side for a nonprofit. And one of his frustrations was sometimes people, you know, change and they want to come in and, change the system around, which really makes problems for him because then that person might be gone in 3 months. And the other thing is donations. Sometimes the software or the hardware that gets donated is, frankly, not something that they can use.
And then that's tough. You want to honor the gift.
Yes.
At the same time, recognize that from a business standpoint, that gift actually can be more trouble than it's worth. And we've had a couple of instances of that in my past experience in IT at the Historical Society, where, yes, very well-intentioned people would bring in a computer and say, I'd like to donate this to you. And we would accept it and we would find a place for it, but it would usually be, you know, for special cases. But at the same time, sometimes you need to be able to say, we really appreciate it, but, we have a particular standard of how we do things and this may be too old, et cetera. That's tough because you don't want donors and supporters to feel turned down. So that can be sensitive. I'm particularly, interested in the skills that people can donate. I think that if, for example, if there's a photographer out there who you know who is willing to take some pictures of your products, or if you know somebody who writes well, who's willing to maybe write a couple of blog posts for you, those kinds of gifts are really very valuable, very valuable.
Gary in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, how are you, Larry?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Well, with you and the family. And Paul is doing an amazing job of demystifying websites.
Thank you, Gary.
I helped run a refugee camp in Africa, and I'm now trying to develop an NGO in order to help the people. And I have a couple of questions. One is, you didn't really explain the difference between designing the website as you might do on WordPress, and I think WordPress might require you then to have them as the host. The second thing being hosting the website. The two can be separate, or some of the easier ones appear to require you to then be hosted on their website. Could you address that before I ask you a couple more questions?
Sure. Yeah, certainly. So it's a great question, and partly because I take a lot of this for granted, and I forget that there are certain kind of bigger concepts that need to be explained. So one of the great things about the internet is that you can have a website that is hosted anywhere in the world, and it can be accessible anywhere in the world. China is a little bit blocked at the moment, but all of my hosted websites are actually at a data center in Southern California. Mm. So where it's physically hosted is not as relevant today as it used to be in the past. So in our case, I use a hosting company that provides services for WordPress. It allows me to easily install WordPress and configure that and create a website hosted as part of my hosting account. There are certainly Wisconsin hosting web hosting companies. There are even some in Madison. And so those are essentially computer servers that are running internet or websites and where you can host your website. Usually what comes with that hosting service is also email accounts. They handle your domain registration as well. And they may provide a variety of other services such as databases and other kinds of things. So that is the hosting side of it. In those cases, that hosting company allows me to easily install WordPress onto that service. And I can create, I think I'm currently running about 10 different websites under my one account. They're all WordPress sites and they're all different web domains. So they're all hosted as with that hosting company.
And did you buy all those web domains from the same site, like GoDaddy or Register.com, or are they from different places you purchased those domains?
Yeah, good question. So the hosting company I'm using, they have their own domain registration. So it's one of the reasons why I enjoy this company so much is I can go in and I can say, I want this domain. I can pay $12 for it. I can then create a website and then press a button and say install WordPress, and it installs it for me. So it does, and then once I have that domain, I can create multiple email accounts, all in that one hosting company. So that's all one place. Now, certainly GoDaddy and Register.com, they're domain companies that are now adding web hosting and email hosting services as an add-on, a value-added product. And so I'm not a fan of that because it's additional to my domain, whereas I start with the hosting company and then they handle the domain for me. That doesn't mean that you could buy your domain from GoDaddy and still use a different hosting company. They will work together. The distinction between that and, for example, WordPress.com is that WordPress.com, such as Blogger or Tumblr, those are online services that allow you to basically have an account and log into their website, and you don't have to install any software. You can just use Blogger or Tumblr and create your Tumblr site or your Blogger site or your WordPress site and pay them. They're not a domain hosting site. They are a web service, basically a web service. So you're not going to get email accounts through Blogger. You would create your email account under some other hosting service.
Well, it sounds like what you suggested earlier anyway, related to compromise, you're better off to use more than one site for that.
Go ahead.
But I have a question related to donations. There are some sites that allow you to donate right on the site, and I don't understand how that works, how the money comes back to the organization in order for them to do the work that they're promoting on the website.
You know, I think that's a question that probably a lot of people have, Gary, and it's a very good one. We are going to take a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we will be back with Paul Hedges, and Paul will take that up as soon as we're back from this look at the news. Again, our guest, Paul Hedges, Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Library and Archives Division. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.
Computers and all the gadgets that we rely on to connect with the world through the Internet have become a part of daily life at home and at work, certainly. They can be great tools until they're not working, and then you're stuck, kind of. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Paul Hedges has, for many years, been the Information Technology Director at Wisconsin Historical Society. He's now the Emerging Technologies Archivist in the Society's Library and Archives Division, works on digital and audiovisual collections and projects, and consults with small business, nonprofits, and churches to help them plan for and manage their website. And Paul, thanks again for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Enjoying it.
It's been a lot of fun for me so far, and I hope it has been for you. And we had a caller on. Gary was wondering, among other things, he's setting up this site and he would like to get donations for this nonprofit, and wonders how does that work if you've got a place on your site that says you can donate here or whatever. How does that work?
So essentially what kind of the big picture is that you have a service, a service that is able to process online transactions. It's then usually that service is then tied to your bank account. There are many services out there, but the typical process is that you sign up for that service. PayPal is one that many places use, but there are others, and each of them will cater to a particular niche potentially. But the bottom line is that service takes on the technical work of essentially accepting securely a person's name and credit card information, and then getting approval from the card processing company, and then conducting that merchant transaction in the background. And then the company, PayPal, etc., make sure that it gets transferred into your account. So there's a lot of behind the scenes, but ultimately what we want, of course, is we want somebody to click on that donate button, be taken to a web page that looks familiar to the customer. You don't want them to go to a website that then looks so completely different that they can't trust that this is still you. And most of those services provide that, a way to basically customize that that page on their website to make it look like yours. And then they, again, that company handles all the heavy lifting of making sure that that page is a secure page, that the transaction completes and that the money goes into your account.
And then they charge for that, according.
And then they charge. And typically, typically you'll pay a monthly service charge and then usually a percentage per transaction and maybe even a flat fee. So you may pay $50 a month for the service, 4% per transaction on the credit card, and maybe a 25-50 cent, you know, fee per transaction itself. So, of course, you need to make sure that you've factored that into your expenses if you want to. So it's not free to take money over the Internet, that's for sure.
But you can do it in relative safety.
Yes. And that's why I've had some companies or some businesses who say, well, I would like to handle that myself. I say, you know, the risk is really high. You don't want to... all I have to do is look at Target and some of these other large corporations, which have many people looking at this who struggle. It's better to let somebody like PayPal or some of these other companies really, they have the technical people to deal with it. You shouldn't try to ever collect a credit card on your website.
Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, thank you so much for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm an amateur photographer. And I turned 60 last year, and I'm used to using film and the old single-lens reflex cameras. But 2 years ago, I made a conscious decision to get a digital and get a macro lens and an iMac computer in order to take insect pictures. And on my computer, I have iPhoto and Aperture. And I'm downloading into both of those, but more people are telling me I should use Aperture, and there are features that I like. I'm not a stupid person, but I am so flabbergasted as to how to arrange the files in this Aperture program. And I'm in a digital SLR class right now. It's kind of a general one. A lot of different people are in there. But I realize I need to get more specific help with just Aperture. And simply how to rearrange, they call them projects, you know, have a category that says butterflies and beneath it have like swallowtails, fritillaries. And I tried YouTube and I listened and I would reach a point where they took something for granted that I didn't know what they were talking about. So I wondered if your guests could recommend any book for this or any had any ideas so that I just feel so overwhelmed, and I really want to get these shots so I can donate them to groups that protect the environment. I appreciate any help.
Yeah, so Pat, so congratulations on your move to digital. Could you tell me what kind of camera you got?
Yes, hold on now. This is terrible, too. It's a Canon. Hold on, our dog is right underfoot. It's a Canon... Sorry.
That's okay. So it's a Canon EOS?
Yes, it's an EOS. Here it is right here. EOS 60D.
Oh, great. Okay. So I'm a Canon user and love photography as well. I haven't done macro photography, but I've always been interested in it. It sounds like you've got a great project going. So unfortunately, I'm not very familiar with Aperture. I'm a Lightroom user, which I know is a competitor. But what I think what I would suggest is to find a person locally. I see you're in Duluth, is to find a photographer locally who can sit down with you and walk through some of those Aperture questions. One of the nice things about Aperture and Lightroom is that they make it, you know, relatively easy to create groups of photos and then to tag them or give them keywords so that you can find them later. They're very nice for keeping large collections of photos. But unfortunately, I I am a Mac user, but not an Aperture user. So I couldn't give you any specific examples of how to solve that. I definitely agree that Aperture is going to be better for you than iPhoto. And so I think you might look for some local photographers, maybe a local Duluth Aperture interest group could potentially help, and have somebody sit down with you at your computer and walk through that. I was going to suggest YouTube, but it looks like you've already worked through some of those.
Yeah, I could try that again too, but you're right, and I know I just have to do that. I agree.
But good for you on moving into that. I went to digital probably about 8-9 years ago, and it was a big transition.
Yeah.
And certainly managing files, and there's, of course, in digital, there's a tendency to take more images, and which means being tougher on yourself and deleting a lot more. Definitely, you don't want to keep too much stuff around. But good for you. Keep going.
Yeah. Keep at it. Thank you very much, Pat. Gary and Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Hey, I just caught the last half hour of the show, and I'm also a photographer, and I do a lot of artwork, and I work with glass a lot. And so I do carvings in glass with photos and such. And everybody says, hey, do you have a website? And no, I don't. And so I'm going to go back to listen more of the show and such. But could you tell me some of the cost involved maybe setting up a website and maintaining the website?
Yeah, you should definitely, by the way, Gary, go back and listen online to the first part, because it's going to be very helpful. But costs?
Yes. So as a photographer, what I would suggest, especially for starting out, is to find an online service that essentially can provide an easy way for you to create a website on the fly. So I'm just going to pick one. I'm not endorsing this, but there's a service called Squarespace, which comes essentially, you pay a monthly or an annual fee. You don't have to have any special software. And it has a variety of templates or designs specifically for photographers. And so once you create that account, you pick the design you want. You upload some images to it. You can create photo galleries. You can create pages like about me, about my work. Do you sell your products?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So then I believe even Squarespace has a store functionality, so you can pay a little extra. So you could add a store to that. And again, Squarespace is one of many services that do this. There's a photo service called Smug Mug. Funny name, yes, smugmug.com, which is allows photographers to sell their prints. So you're going to pay monthly or annually. To answer your question about cost, think of it as your time, certainly. If you outsource to somebody else, you're going to pay that person. Typically, web designers will either do a flat fee where they say, for $500, we will build a website that has 5 pages, and you can we'll do 2 rounds of review, or you can pay somebody by the hour. With some place like Squarespace, where they're handling the hosting, you would pay that fee, which could be anywhere between $10 a month and $100, $200 a year. And then, of course, your time, your time to maintain it.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask one more question, please?
Sure.
That my internet provider, I believe they provide a free web page. Is that something to do?
I would I guess I would move away. I would say no, mostly because if you're thinking of establishing a business, one of the things you'll want to do is get a domain. And so if it's, you know, Gary's Glass, designs.com or something like that, you'd want to definitely go out and look for a domain name and then be able to apply that domain name to whatever service you're using. Usually these one-page web hosting sites, you're not going to get that. You're not going to and you'll quickly learn that it's it doesn't really help as much.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thanks, Gary, for calling. Bob in Eau Claire, hi, thank you for calling.
Turn it down. Hi, I'm responding to the woman in Duluth who is looking for information on a Mac users group. And I am a member of a users group. I live in Eau Claire. But there's a users group in Duluth. It's called the School of Medicine Mac Users Group, or SMMUG. And there's a contact person by the name of Steve Tigman, T-I-G-G-M-A-N. And she can look him up on Facebook. She can send him a message, become a friend, and then send him a message. They usually meet on the second Thursday of each month, and they are an excellent group. Steve isn't real good about pre-announcing the meetings, but they are held unless, you know, some severe weather or whatever were to intervene. They're held right at the University of Minnesota Duluth at the School of Medicine, which is why it's called that. That would be the best possible thing that she could do, and then they can help her find other people to branch out and give her more specific advice.
Wow. Bob, that's great. Again, it's Steve Tigman,
T-I-G-G-M-A-N. Mm-hmm. In fact, it may be two N's, but if she got, you know,
he'll
nickname
pop up.
Is Tig, so she should be able to find it directly on Facebook.
And the acronym was SMUG.
SMUG, S-M-M-U-G.
Yeah, all right. Bob, thank you.
Yeah, that's great.
That's great. I really appreciate it. And Joy in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Good morning. I sometimes I find that when I'm on a chain of links throughout the Internet, I lose the back arrow. That's a short way to put it. I start out on Ravelry, and I go to small designers or big companies, yarn sites, and their site doesn't have a back arrow. I have to just X out. Is that something that they're doing on purpose or accidentally? And it might be something that people should think about avoiding when they're starting a little website.
It's a good question. So my guess, based on what you just said, is that when you're clicking on a link, it's taking you to a completely separate website. Is that correct?
Right. Uh-huh.
So typically what happens, and we use this on our websites as well at the Circle Society, is that if we send somebody to another website, we'll typically open a new tab or a new window. And so because it's opening a new window, there's no page to go back to. So do you typically see that is like when you click on something? Can I ask what browser you're using?
I think it's Internet Explorer.
Okay. So typically if you click on a link that's going, essentially opening a new window, you'll see another tab show up at the top of the page. What that does is essentially is just opening a separate window. And so there would not be a back button because there's no page to go back to.
Hmm.
And the reason why they do that is because they're trying to be helpful. They're trying to help you not lose the page you were looking at before. So you can click from one window to the next and be able to jump to that other site, but also click on the tab to see the site you were just on. So that is my guess as what's happening and why you don't see the back button is because there's no previous page because it's the first page you've gone to it, on that new tab.
Is that something that new designers should think about, or just comes automatically with their package?
It is a conscious decision when people create a page if they're sending somebody to a new website, they're going to open a new window. That is pretty standard practice. And so designers, I think it's going to depend. It's not something that's built in. It's something that designers or the person who codes the page has put in manually. So
probably not going to change.
I think as a general rule of thumb, it's standard practice now to do that.
Yeah. Thank you for calling, Joy. I appreciate it. And I want to give Bill and Appleton a chance to get in. Bill, hi.
Yes, hi. I only missed 5 minutes of the whole show, so I hope you didn't cover this already. My business associate is looking to have someone put together a website for him, and he's been told that in order for search engines to do a good job in placement, in other words, placing his page up near the top, that a couple of things have to happen besides putting in meta tags. He would have to do things like repeat text within pages on the website and change text on pages of the website fairly frequently and even create a blog of some sort on the website in order for apparently all of these things work together to improve placement. Can you speak to that? Does this ring true for you? And
yeah, unfortunately it does. And I think of course, Google pretty much owns search. You know, Bing is around, and certainly Yahoo Search is still around, and people use that. But everybody is trying to make sure that they show up in the top five search results on Google for certain terms. So what happens is search optimization companies go out and they basically reverse engineer what Google's secret formula is for making sure that people show up in good search results. And as I mentioned earlier about, for example, making sure that certain terms are part of your link, is that there are ways to make sure that those terms that you want people to find you under are ranked higher, so that you rank at a higher level because of that. So certain things such as making sure that you're actually using those terms. I think very often I find somebody will say, well, I searched for X and I didn't find my website. And then I say, well, do you use that word on your website? They say, no, I don't. I'm like, well, then that's your first thing you need to take care of. The duplication or repeating of that is important, as well as again, the links, making sure the links have the words. And also what you referred to the blog is that you want to have other websites that link to you. So engaging other websites and having them link to you is important. That helps your search engine.
Paul, this has been wonderful. I hope you can come back and be with us again. We'd really love to have you back.
Great. Yeah, I had fun.
Paul Hedges, our guest today, emerging technologies archivist in the Society's Wisconsin Historical Society's Library and Archives Division. Great, a great show today, and we will have him back and talk to them again. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it works. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.